Let's talk. Talk. John Brown. Three revolutions: Russia, China, Cuba, and the epic journeys that changed the world. It's a fascinating new book from Simon Hall, from the streets of Petrograd during the heady autumn of 1917 to Mao's stunning victory in 49 and Fidel Castro's triumphant arrival in Havana. It is not only the story of three revolutions, it is three journeys, but not only that, it's three correspondents and journalists as well. Ask questions about the role of journalism in today's society as well. I'm delighted to say that joining me live on the line from somewhere probably on the road to Havana is Simon Hall himself. Simon, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Good morning. Yeah, sadly not, I'm in Leeds, but yeah, I'd love to be on the way to Havana.
All great journeys start with a single step, so there you go.
True. Yeah.
Now, you've written obviously, was it 10 Days in Havana, which I think Hannah Murray, my colleague, interviewed you about a while back.
Yeah. 10 Days in Harlem. 10 Days in Harlem. Fidel's trip to Harlem in 1960, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what the spark was then behind this book to talk about three revolutions. Because people go, oh, well, it's just communism, isn't it? But it's so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, originally I wanted to write about the three journalists, three American journalists, John Reed, Edgar Snow and Herbert Matthews, who wrote these brilliant and controversial and what turned out to be really influential reports on the, you know, firsthand eyewitness accounts of the Russian, Chinese and Cuban revolutions. And then I was encouraged to do more about the revolutions themselves. And at some point, I just realized that journeys were at the center of both of these things. Both journeys were central to the revolutions that took place in Russia, China and Cuba. And the journalists, these three journalists, in order to get these extraordinary scoops, embarked on kind of epic journeys of their own. And so I thought that pairing up these journeys would be a great way of exploring both the revolutions and the journalists.
Because, excuse my ignorance, and there's an awful lot of ignorance when it comes to dealing with me, but one of the things that I sort of, because 1917, okay, I mean, Germany is, Russia is just literally imploded on the Eastern Front, as it were. Doesn't the Kaiser sort of kick Lenin out to go and make mischief? Or have I got, and if so, you know, I mean, Lenin doesn't say, all right, I'm going to be leaving toward, in the general direction of Russia, you know, on the 330 out of Berlin. Any foreign correspondent that wish to join me. So how does that all work out, Simon?
Yeah. So, I mean, Lenin is in exile in Switzerland in 1917 when there are two revolutions in Russia in 1917. There's one in February, which leads to the overthrow of the Tsar and the creation of a provisional government. And as soon as Lenin hears the news, he's like, I've got to get back to Russia. But he can't get back to Russia because he either has to go through France and Britain, who are not going to let him because he's famous person in the world arguing for Russia to stop fighting, yeah. And Britain and France want Russia desperately to stay in the war. And the only other way through is to go through Imperial Germany, which is a war with Russia. And if he just went through Germany, he'd be arrested as a spy. So in the end, reluctantly, he does a deal with the German government, who see it in their interest to kind of smuggle him back into Russia, to advocate for Russia leaving the war in the hopes that they can then switch all of their forces to the Western Front, knock out France and Britain before America joins the war. So he does a deal with the devil, basically, because Imperial Germany represents absolutely everything that Lenin is against: imperialism, capitalism, aristocracy, militarism. But he takes a load of gold and the Germans put on a special train, a so-called sealed train, which is a sort of legal ruse that the bit of the train that Lenin and his comrades are in is not technically travelling through Germany. It's given extraterritorial status, a bit like a kind of embassy on wheels.
Yeah.
And they travel through Germany and then up through Scandinavia. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, if the Kaiser had said no, or if some unfortunate bomb had gone off in that particular carriage, that would have got rid of, you know, history could have been entirely different, Simon.
It could have been, yeah. And there's a moment when they get to the border with Finland, which is part of the Russian, or what had been the Russian Empire. And as part of the wartime agreement, there's a British security guy on the border post. Think of a way to stop Lenin entering Russian territory. And you know, if he'd just decided to shoot him, then the Russian Revolution wouldn't have taken place. At least it wouldn't have taken place in the way that it did in October. And the history of the 20th century would have been hugely different. So, yeah, on that journey, really, the history of 20th century Europe kind of hinged, really.
So how does the journalist get wind of this then? Is it an absolute scoop then, or does he join him at a certain point? I mean, does he smuggle himself onto the? I mean, how does that one work? And obviously, we say the journalist. I mean, obviously, you've got to be particularly dogged correspondent to because this isn't like getting, you know, the 8:15 out of Clapham to Leeds, is it? I mean, it's a particularly difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, John Reed, he's not the only journalist who covers the Russian Revolution, but he's the most famous and the most influential. And he's a kind of radical. He's a socialist. He's a bohemian. He's a poet. He's been a major war correspondent. And in August of 1917, he decides to go to Russia to see for himself what's going on. And it takes him a month. He travels by steamliner across the Atlantic, and then by train through Scandinavia, and arrives in Petrograd at the start of September on the Russian calendar. And he's literally outside the gates of the Winter Palace when it gets stormed by the Bolsheviks. And he strikes up close friendships with, particularly with Lenin and Trotsky. For a time, he actually works for the new revolutionary government. In the foreign ministry, helping to produce propaganda newspapers to try to encourage German troops to desert, and he writes it all up in an amazing book called 10 Days That Shook the World, which is one of the most famous works of journalism of the 20th century.
It's, I mean, again, my timelines might be getting a bit mixed up here, Simon, so please correct me if I'm wrong. This is presumably America are very interested in helping sort of the new Russia at this point, as they will do sort of in the 90s and the noughties to their chagrin. But is this before sort of all the civil war breaks out and we've got the Siberian situation and American troops coming in via Vladivostok? Am I going too late in my timelines here?
Yeah, it's before that. So the American government is supportive of the provisional government.
Yeah.
Which at the time of the revolution, the October Revolution, is led by a guy called Alexander Kerensky. And when the Bolsheviks take power in October of 1917, the American government is initially kind of there's a debate about whether it should recognize the new Bolshevik government. And there are some people who are saying, you know, they've taken power, you need to recognize them. And in the end, they don't. They help launch this attempt to chuck out the Bolsheviks, which leads to the civil war. But this is taking place before that.
Who's he sending his correspondence back to? Because if he is very much in support of what Lenin's trying to do, the Bolsheviks, etc. I mean, is the America? Are there? I can't really see the Hearst publications being very, very, very interested at all in what he's sending back, because obviously they're the opposite end of the spectrum. So who's he writing for?
Yeah, so he's writing primarily for a kind of left-wing audience back in the United States, particularly newspaper like The Liberator, which has a relatively small circulation. So his first-hand, because of the wartime censorship in the United States too, the newspaper articles that he writes in the autumn of 1917 don't reach a very wide audience. It's really the book that he writes up on his return to America that gets published in early 1919, which is the one that gets the attention. It becomes a bestseller. 10 Days That Shook the World. So it's really the book for John Reed. It's the book rather than the immediate newspaper reports that really make his reputation and have the impact.
We've got two others to get through. So I can tell we could talk about this for the next sort of 20 minutes or so. But does Reed still does he remain a committed Bolshevik? Does he remain enamored to the dream throughout his career, or as the revolution progresses, does he fall out of love with the ideals?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, he returns to America a committed Bolshevik, advocates for the equivalent of Bolshevism in the United States, becomes a co-founder of one of two communist parties which are founded in the United States, then returns to Russia. And then there's a big debate about whether he, in the last months of his life, he dies in 1920, whether in the last months of his life he's becoming disillusioned with what he views already as a kind of increasingly kind of centralized, inflexible way of organizing politics in Russia. So there's some evidence that by the time he dies of typhus in Moscow, in the last months of his life, he's become a bit more skeptical about what's going on. I think it seems pretty clear that if he'd lived, he wouldn't have become a committed Stalinist in the 1930s. But we don't know that for sure because he doesn't live to see where the revolution goes.
Now, there's three in this one, and I'll come to the last one because that's, if you like, that's perhaps the most media friendly, if you like. But the Long March. Now, people may have heard of this. You know, our parents were all for holding the. You know, it was 1960s. It was the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, and we've got the Long March, and that's pretty much, I suppose, that everybody will kind of know about now, unless they've got the Andy Warhol print hanging in their houses. This is really interesting because this is China, and had things gone differently, the nationalists could have persevered, and if the Americans hadn't pulled out in Chiang Kai-shek, you'd be looking at an entirely different global political system. But it's not. So give me, if you can, Simon, here's your curveball for the day. What's happening in 1948 in China 101?
Well, I mean, the Long March is in 1930. So it's basically the communists have established a kind of proto-state in the southeast of China, and the nationalists have been determined to smash it. And so they've put all these military resources in to try to destroy the communists, to annihilate the communists once and for all. And the communists decide they have to abandon this base and try to break the blockade, and so that's the Long March. Basically, it starts in October 1934. It's about 100,000 troops and communist officials and leaders set off, and it's basically a military retreat. And it takes a year, 12 months. They cover 6,000 miles. They cross 11 of China's 28 provinces. They have to go through like 18 mountain ranges. They have to cross 24 rivers. There are a dozen major battles. And they eventually, they persevere. They find sanctuary ultimately up in the northwest in Shanxi, not too far from Yan'an. And off the 100,000 or so that set off, about 6,000 men. But crucially, among the 6,000 that make it are all the major leaders of the communist movement, including Mao. Zhou Enlai, and all the major military leaders. And they then regroup and kind of start again. And they go on to form a temporary alliance with the nationalists during the Second World War to take on the Japanese. And then that alliance breaks apart and the communists win.
So who is covering this one then? Because this would seem to be a very sort of, a China first policy, if you like. This would be an internal story behind, because, at the time, China in the 30s, it's not really, is it attracting that much from the Western powers? Is it attracting that much attention? Because it seems to be sort of teetering on the edge of it is going to fall apart, when the Japanese invade, to put it mildly, and they've been having a go at sort of like Nanking or whatever, for decades now. So why is this of interest to a Western readership, as it were, Simon?
Yeah, I think it's becoming more and more of interest to the West. Mainly because of the role of Japan,
right?
And Japan's kind of expansionist ambitions in the Far East, which are seen as a threat to the United States. So I think the China story becomes really important in the United States, mainly because of the role of Japan. And so this American journalist, Edgar Snow, who's based in China, he's been living in China for about a decade before, is really well placed to report on it. And the story about the communist movement in China is one that is really nobody knows about because there's so much censorship in China. No Western journalist has managed to interview or travel to communist areas and report on it. And Edgar Snow is the first one to do it. So he's the one who kind of breaks the censorship blockade and tells this story for the first time about the communist movement in China to the world, and particularly to the West. And he reports very sympathetically about the Chinese communist movement as he encounters it in 1936 in Shanxi, where they've relocated. And he interviews Mao over several days, and much of what we all know, or what historians know today about Mao's early life, pretty much all of it comes from the interviews he did with Edgar Snow.
Yeah, because that's really interesting. So you think Mao, and you think that inscrutable sort of bald-headed, like late early 50s-something, overlooking.
That's Lingmao, that sort of Fat Mao.
Fat Mao, yeah, exactly. It's like Ho Chi Minh. You always think about Ho Chi Minh being this old guy with a beard. You don't think about young Ho Chi Minh working in a, you know, working in a, I think, what was it, working in London and Paris, for example. In the, so what's Thin Mao like then?
Well, he's very impressive. I mean, one thing is he's almost always asleep during the morning. So there's lots of times when Edgar Snow is doing stuff and like all the leadership are out, but Mao's has to lay in. Right. He wears his hair long. He tends not to wear a military cap in those days.
Right.
He strikes Snow as someone who's very impressive, has a lot of charisma. He's always had an enthusiasm for physical fitness. He's kind of inspirational. He sees him, the man he compares him to is Lincoln. He sees him as a kind of Lincoln type figure. So it's a very different kind of Mao to the one that we are all kind of familiar with in terms of late Mao. He's young, he's fit, he's kind of fun to be around. You know, he's not the Mao of the
Cultural Revolution.
Cultural Revolution and the disasters that come. Yeah, he seems a very different kind of figure, at least to Snow at that point. Yeah.
And again, is this going back to a specific American audience, or is it being picked up by Washington trying to formulate plans? Because obviously they got nobody in there, so presumably somebody who's writing about the situation has access to the communists at this point. Or is it too nascent? Is it too early in there to even be moved? Because they're, if you're like a fringe group after so many fringe groups in that particular part of the world.
Yeah, so the book that he publishes, which is called Red Star Over China, is a huge bestseller in Britain, actually. It reaches a huge audience in Britain and then also influential in the United States. I don't think Snow has direct influence on the American government, but there are certainly people in the Roosevelt administration, particularly Frank Roosevelt's kind of right-hand man, a guy called Harold Ickes, who reads Red Star Over China and basically says, look, if Snow's right, the Chinese communists are probably going to win. They're a real force to be reckoned with. So his reporting does have an influence, not just on kind of the wider kind of popular perceptions of the communist movement, but on politicians who are, you know, on influential political figures and politicians in the late 1930s.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about that. We get to the more glamorous one, if you like, the more media friendly one, which is of course Fidel Castro, because he's against the, you know, because Havana, you know, we all think about, you know, pre-revolution, so it's all sort of big cars and Sinatra playing and sipping a Cuba Libre or whatever, and, you know, tobacco plantations, and then a repressive regime, which then changes. So presumably he's been kicked out by the repressive regime that is in Havana in the early 50s.
Yeah. So Fidel has been a kind of professional revolutionary for a few years. He'd launched an attempt to overthrow the Batista government in 1953 with a raid on a major barracks, the Moncada Barracks in Santiago, which is Cuba's second city, which had failed almost immediately. They'd been spotted and they'd been pinned down, and most of his comrades had been killed or arrested. And Fidel is captured, sent to prison as a famous trial where he defends himself and gives a very famous speech, and then he's sent to prison for 3 years. And then Batista, under pressure from the Americans to show that he's not that bad after all, basically releases them all. And a few weeks later, Fidel heads off to Mexico with a promise that he'll return with the dictator's head at his feet. And so he spends the first part of 1956 kind of organizing a kind of a guerrilla army in Mexico, you know, getting new recruits, buying weapons, eventually buying the boat that they're going to go back to Cuba on, the Granma.
Yep.
And then at the end of November, they set off from the port city of Tuxpan and head back to Cuba on this boat. It's designed for about 24 people, and they've got over 80 packed on board. The boat almost sinks. It's a bit of a disastrous journey. The gears are so badly worn that it takes them about twice as long as it should to get there. And then they eventually land just off the coast in a mangrove swamp, and have to kind of wade their way through with their knees and their hands getting cut to shreds before they finally make it onto dry land. Yeah.
And we like to drop the C word in here. Is Che turned up at this point?
Yeah, Che's one of the first people that Fidel meets in the summer of, I think it's the summer of 1955 or 56, yeah. In Mexico, and Che's immediately captured, enraptured, yeah, whatever the word is, by Fidel's charisma. And even though he thinks this is never going to work, he kind of can't but join it. He's like, but it's going to work. You know, he's kind of, Fidel has this huge confidence that he's going to succeed. And so Che is one of the people on the, one of the key people on the boat.
Can I ask this question, Simon, just quickly? Who's running Mexico at the time? Because, I mean, because Che is fomenting revolution bleeding everywhere in South America, and Fidel's not exactly the most conservative person to have around. Surely the Mexican authorities are going to be a bit concerned. They've got a hotbed of terrorists, or sorry, revolutionaries, excuse me, on their doorstep.
Yeah, they are. I can't remember who the president of Mexico is at the time, but there's a period just a few months before they go to Cuba where they're arrested, and a former president of Mexico who's in exile in America kind of put some pressure on them to release them. Because Mexico is theoretically still a revolutionary government, and so it doesn't look great for its public relations to imprison revolutionaries. So they kind of relent. But then it's also clear they're not going to allow them to continue to operate there. So the kind of net is closing in again, which prompts them to leave Mexico in a bit of haste, really.
So we've got 80 people or so on a boat designed for 20. And is the correspondent sort of paddling in a kayak behind them sort of thing? And hello, Che. Hello, Castro. I mean, who is our journalist on this one, our correspondent, and why is he there?
So this is a correspondent for the New York Times called Herbert Matthews, who's made his name really as a war correspondent covering the wars in the Italian War in Ethiopia, the Civil War in Spain, and then the Second World War. And he's kind of retired, stepped back a bit from war reporting, but he's kind of an editorial writer and a kind of roving Latin American correspondent for the New York Times. And this happens a few months after the landing. Most of Fidel's forces are either captured or killed. There's a kind of ragtag remnant which kind of escape into the Sierra Maestra Mountains in December, just before Christmas, and start to regroup. And in February, they basically want an American foreign correspondent to come out and do an interview to get, a big scoop, to get publicity, to show that Fidel is alive, because the Batista regime has been claiming that he's been killed, and to kind of inject a kind of new energy into their revolution. And so they pick, or the person that gets picked is Herbert Matthews, and he travels to Havana, gets driven across the island to Manzanillo in the east, and then is kind of smuggled into the mountains, hikes up the mountains for a kind of secret meeting with Fidel, and interviews him for about 3 or 4 hours. They smoke some cigars, some photographs, and he's smuggled back out, goes back to New York, writes up the report, which hits the on, I think it's 27th of February 1957.
And this isn't boring you to death, Fidel, with an eight day speech. This is vibrant Fidel. Everybody's got the picture of Che on their walls alongside the picture of Mao. But Fidel is the brains, is the maestro, isn't he? And he is charismatic.
Yeah, extraordinarily so, and magnetic personality. And Matthews is completely taken by Fidel, I think. He writes about his physicality. He's tall, he's strong, he's got flashing eyes. The way that Matthews describes it, Fidel kind of embodies the kind of the youthful idealism of Cuba. He comes across in Matthews' report as extraordinarily charismatic and idealistic, and someone that people are going to be drawn to. It paints a very romantic picture of Fidel and the wider rebel movement, really. Matthews is later accused of having kind of fashioned this image of Fidel as a kind of Robin Hood of the Antilles or of the Caribbean. This kind of plucky folk hero who's going to kind of stick it to the man.
Yeah, but you see, in an age before social media and spin, this is social media and spin. Why do you think everybody's got a picture of Mao and Che? Because they're flashy and they are political influencers. I mean, I hate to use the term, Simon, but they're political influencers. You don't have to know much of the politics, but they look good. And, even though the Castro regime eats some of its children, to put it mildly, and there are people involved who land with Che, who are then later, land with Fidel, who are later involved with the Bay of Pigs, for example. At the time, it's that whole, as you said, it's charismatic. They're all charismatic. And that, perhaps, Simon, is a question that you ask in the book. I mean, where does journalism finish and where does idealism begin? You know, how much spin are the press under at this point, historically and to the present day?
Yeah, I think it's I think that's definitely true. I mean, all three of these journalists, to different degrees, are sympathetic to the causes they're writing about. I mean, John Reed is a committed socialist, and ultimately, I mean, as I said, he works for the new Bolshevik government. So, and he admits that in 10 days, he says, "You know, I'm no impartial observer, but I've tried to write down things as I saw them to the best of my ability." Edgar Snow and Herbert Matthews are. They're not signed up members of these movements, but they're definitely sympathetic to the causes they're writing about. I think it's always important to remember that they're writing about these moments, these revolutionary movements and moments before the revolutions have kind of happened or have kind of played out as they do. So, you know, they're writing about the Bolsheviks, you know, before the terror of the 1930s. They're writing about Mao, you know, before the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. Communist before he's a communist, when he's really inspired mainly by Cuban nationalism. So they write sympathetic reports about movements that strike them as sympathetic at the time, but which are also exciting because they're kind of new, and they're clearly against something which is, you know, certainly in China and in Cuba, they're against regimes which are corrupt and violent and oppressive. And so I think all of them are committed, even though that they have this sympathy for what they're writing about, the causes they're writing about. They understand this tension, and they're also trying to write accurately and truthfully and honestly as best they can. And so they're trying to kind of navigate that.
The book is called Three Revolutions. I'm going to run out of time. Simon, if people want to follow you online, where's the best place to find you?
I'm on Simon Hall Writer on both Twitter, or X as it is now, and Blue Sky.
The book is called Three Revolutions. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you so much. You've been brilliant. Thanks.